Okay, today is April 20th, and we're at the Concord Free Public Library. And I'm Michael Klein, and Carrie Klein is here with me. It's a gray, cold day. Makes you wonder if spring's ever going to come. And maybe you can introduce yourself, say my name is.
Yeah, I'm Don Prentice.
Okay, and your date of birth?
It's 9/5/46.
And maybe you'd start off and tell us about your people and where you were raised.
Okay. I grew up in West Concord, and my dad grew up in West Concord also. But my grandfather came to Concord as a young man, and he lived on Walden Street. His father passed away, and so he lived with the Bartlett family, and his mother, who was Eliza Pennyman's, her father ran the Wright Tavern. The church bought the tavern, and they hired him to run it. So there is a history of the Wright Tavern, and in it it talks about Otis Pennyman being hired to run the tavern, but he wasn't much of an innkeeper. So I think he ran the poorhouse at first, so they thought he might be able to run the tavern. But he didn't do a very good job, from what I understand.
The Wright Tavern?
Yes.
What and where is that?
The Wright Tavern is in the center of town. It's where the British soldiers had their command posts on the morning of April 19th. And I guess at one point it was kind of a downtrodden inn and not very well liked by the community, and I guess at some point it became available for sale, and the church bought it, and they've owned it ever since, and that's when they hired my grandfather, Otis Pennyman, to run it. And
he had run the poorhouse before that?
Yeah, they had a poorhouse. I don't know much about it, really, just that he ran it, and it describes it in this book about the Wright Tavern. But I don't know much about it. But there used to be a building across from the Walden Street Fire Station that everybody always called it the poorhouse. And at one point it was torn down, and now there's a residential home there. So, you know, there must have been people at some point in the early or late 1800s that were considered poor and needed a place to live. I don't think there's any more poor people in Concord, because the houses seem to be pretty lavish. And I bought a little house on White Pond years ago, and my wife and I are quite comfortable there.
Is that within the town limits?
Yeah, it's in South Concord. It's what they call Nine Acre Corner, or White Pond.
So Thoreau writes that the boys in town were always there first. It didn't matter what was going on. If it was the blueberries were ripe and he was going out to pick some blueberries, yeah, he found that the boys had already been there. If it was a fire, somebody reported, he went to the fire, the boys were already at the fire. The boys always were a step ahead of everybody.
Yeah.
I wondered how that was in your generation.
I don't know what you mean by boys. Just
the boy kids growing up.
Yeah.
The boys, gangs of boys.
Yeah.
Running around.
Well, there seem to always be different gangs around town, but not typical of the gangs you see today.
It
was,
no.
Was the Italian section behind the depot. That was the depot gang. But you talk about blueberries. When I was a child, along Old Marlboro Road, and what now is MacArthur Road, was loaded with blueberries. And my dad used to take a fruit juice can and put a string on it, and we could go out in 15 or 20 minutes, have the can full of blueberries the size of a dime. And they're all wild blueberries, but you very rarely see them anymore around town. So
what bunch did you run with or lead?
I didn't really run with a gang. I just sort of... I enjoyed being with everybody. I had some friends that were, I wasn't the best of students, but I had friends that were horrible students, but then I used to socialize with some of the the more intellectual, I guess you'd call them, or wealthier kids in town. They just had that ability to have a good time with just about anybody. And I got my best friend is Doug McCone, and I met him at the Junior Sociables, which they used to have at the Scout House. And that was on Saturday night. And they'd always had a horrible band. But, you know, it was something, you know, my parents would drag me to. And, you know, after 15 or 20 minutes, Doug McCone and I were gone. You know, but we would come back towards the end of the program so that our parents could pick us up. But, you know, it was really, then it was horrible. But I think about it now, and it was kind of exciting back then. But
where'd you guys go when you took off?
We went just downtown, down around the Mill Dam, you know, just stay out of sight. And, you know, until, you know, we figured this program was over, and then we'd come back. But the band was always terrible. You know, it's not today like, I mean, I guess it was a professional band, but it was an accordion and a bass player and a saxophonist. You know, it just doesn't make for great music, I don't think.
So what was there for boys to do, to get into growing up?
Well, in Concord, there was a teen center, but that, what I enjoyed about Concord is the history. I mean, there was always some place to go and see the history, like the Old Manse or the Alcott House or just, you know, Great Woods. You know, we had Walden Pond, White Pond, we canoed on the river. And I worked for George Rowan for a couple of years as a teenager, and I used to rent the canoes on Saturdays and Sundays. And towards the end of the day, my buddies would show up and, you know, we'd all grab a canoe and canoe up and down the river and, you know, tip each other over. And we used to, you know, and then as we got older, one of my friends had a motorboat. And, you know, we were all, you know, 80 pounds soaking wet and would water ski up the river to Fairhaven Bay. You know, it's just, there was a lot of stuff to do in town. You know, and it was horses. There was Elmbrook Farm, Victory Lee Stables. I still ride horses today. I've been riding with the Concord Independent Battery for 43 years. And
the Concord Independent Battery?
Yeah, Concord has their own artillery. And one of the reasons the British came to Concord in 75 was to look for brass cannon. And they, you know, reportedly that the colonials had, and they were hidden out, supposedly at Barrett's Farm on Barrett's Mill Road. And that's one of the reasons they came to Concord. Well, the guns were disassembled, from what I understand, hidden in the fields. And I don't really know what quite happened to them after that, but I do know that Concord always had an artillery company. And it was originally called the Concord Artillery. And in 1804, I hope my history is correct, the adjutant general wanted the guns back. And the town refused to give them the guns. And they went to the legislature, and the legislature gave the town permanent custody of the cannons. And the two original cannons, one is in the Bunker Hill Monument, and the other one is up at the Visitor Center on Liberty Street. The original, there are two bronze cannons that the town had for a number of years, and they were condemned as being unfit for use. So they're in Doric Hall in the State House on permanent display. And the state gave the town two more cannons, and they're here in the gun house on Lexington Road. And we take them out every April 19th and fire we did the parade, which was on the 18th this year, and then we did the dawn salute on the morning of the 19th. And this has been going on since 1804. Yeah. My grandfather was involved with it somewhat, but my father never had any interest. But like I say, I've been doing it for 43 years.
Yeah. 43 years, that would have made you about 22 or something when you
started in 1968.
How did you, was there an application process to get in, or how did you?
Well,
join
no,
up?
I knew Dick Ryan, who was with the fire department at the time, and he was a member of the battery. And Lawrence Kenny, who had a farm on Virginia Road, found out I had a horse and I knew how to ride. So I was sort of told that you're going to ride with a battery. So I said, that's all great, fine, excellent. You know, because I used to, you know, in the morning go up and watch them fire on the 19th, and always thought it'd be neat. So I, you know, sort of invited to ride with a battery. And, you know, when I bought my first house, of course, the horse had to go. Couldn't afford both.
Did they issue you a uniform?
Yeah, we go out and get our own uniforms, but the uniform isn't correct for the period of the cannons. The cannons are model 1845, I believe. So that was the year they were made. And I guess what happened is over the years is the uniforms changed with the period. So there is a photograph in the Colonial Inn of the Concord Independent Battery out front that was taken in 1875, and their uniforms are more Civil War type. Then they did another, 1975, they did a picture of the battery again in front of the Colonial Inn to replicate that 100 years, you know, between photographs. And the uniforms are kind of typical of the First and Second World War. The campaign hat, which is sort of the mainstay, it was adopted by the battery. It's not typical of an artillery of that period of 1845, but they kept it because it was readily available. And the uniform is a khaki brown. I think the original uniform was quite striking. I mean, it was like a jacket with tails and stripes and, you know, a hat with plumage and, you know, just pretty spectacular, but not practical for today.
So, describe the whole ritual. Is the cannon loaded once it gets to the site?
Yeah, what we do is the guns are maintained by the Concord Independent Battery, but they are owned by the town. So what we do every year is we go to the town and apply for a contract. We have a contract with the town that will maintain and fire the guns, so, you know, at different town ceremonies. And what we have to do after the first of the year is everybody has to do 20 hours of training before they're allowed to be on an active gun crew. So we practice like Wednesday night for, you know, 2, 3, 4 hours at a time, you know, so everybody can get that 20 hours, because you have to be trained and certified in several positions. Well, the first outing for the battery is April 19th, and what we do is we participate in the parade, but we go a different way than the typical parade, goes up Lowell Road to Liberty Street, but we go Monument Street to the battlefield at the Old Manse, and we set the guns up there. So while the parade comes down through the National Park and across the bridge, we fire a number of volleys. And then what we do is we join in, we hitch up and join in with the end of the parade and come down through town. And this year the parade was on the 18th. So the morning of the 19th, we do the dawn salute at 6 a.m. And we fire several rounds. Typically it was 21, but due to the fact that regulations require that we spend, I think it's 3 minutes between rounds, the Minutemen fire, you know, we fire a round, then the Minutemen fire a volley, and we fire a round, they fire a volley, and we do 21 that way.
So you're being the British?
No, we're just being, it's called the Dawn Salute. And we're not, it has to do with the battle, or the history of the battle, but we're not sides. It's typically the Minutemen who are local. It's a local group that you know, participates in it, but they do a reenactment, but not always. Now, Lexington does a reenactment in their square. We used to do a reenactment at the North Bridge, but time doesn't always allow it. So it's just, you know, the Dawn salute is just that. It's a 21-gun salute that they do on the morning of the 19th and have for, you know, for hundreds of years without stopping, other than during World Wars, like World War One and World War Two, they didn't do the salute. This powder was scarce.
Can you describe how the cannon is loaded? Is it a black powder cannon?
Yeah, it's what they call a 6-pounder. And what we have to do is we take the powder. You know, we're allowed so many ounces per inch of bore. So we take that calculated amount and we put it into a aluminum foil tube that we make. It's basically formed around an old Skippy peanut butter jar, because it's approximately the right size. So we do this sleeve, we put, you know, several ounces of powder. Then we do another sleeve with several ounces of peat moss, and that goes on top, and then it's all twisted together as one charge, and it's typically 6 to 7 inches long and, you know, just under 4 inches in diameter. So, you know, we make up several rounds prior to the event. Then we, like typically on the morning of the 19th, we go through a ritual where everybody is given an assignment, and there's two gun crews. And number one is the rammer. Number two is he puts the powder in the gun. Then there's three and four, and they typically take care of the charge, or the what we use is a 32 blank cartridge that fires the charge. You know, we use what they call a Lyle mechanism. It's a little mechanical device, because originally they used a device that was called a friction device, and it had something to do with a chemical called fulminated mercury. And it wasn't consistent. You know, it didn't always work. It was susceptible to problems. So what they did is they changed the mechanism to what they call a Lyle mechanism that was typically used by the Coast Guard and naval vessels to fire a lanyard from ship to ship, you know, which is a light rope, and then they would pull a heavier rope across. So it was just a more substantial device to fire the guns with. So typically, number one, who is the rammer, would take what they call a sponge, and he would sponge out the barrel. Then he would put the sponge away and get the rammer, which is what we use today. It's just a cardboard tube. In case there's a pre-ignition, the tube just sort of disintegrates, and it doesn't. The theory is that it won't hurt anybody. So when he's ready, he taps the barrel with his rammer. The powder monkey brings the charge down, hands it to number two. Number two swings around over the wheel and slides the charge into the muzzle of the gun. These are what they call muzzle loaders. So it has to be loaded from the front. So then the rammer rams the charge in. Then numbers three and four, put the 32 blank charge in and get the firing mechanism ready. Then when the gun is ready, the gun captain, the gun lieutenant or gunner, will let the captain know that the gun is armed. He'll tell them to proceed. Then they get ready to get into a position where they can fire the cannon. And then at some point, you know, the captain is directed either by portable radio, or it's just, you know, a gut feeling, because typically the predetermined plan doesn't always go the way they thought it would go, and we're supposed to typically fire around after taps and echo, but we can't always hear it. So at some point somebody says, you know, number one gun fire, and off it goes. So if we're, you know, if we're correct, great. If not, well, we will load the other gun and, you know, get ready for another round. So typically we fire several rounds, you know, and as the parade comes across North Bridge and they move down towards Monument Street, we hitch up and pull in behind the parade, and we still use horses to draw the cannons.
Whose horses?
Well, we get them from different places. Typically, we used to get them from, years ago, they used to get them from the prison, used to maintain horses. And they'd either get horses from the prison, or there was a farmer on Barrett's Mill named McGrath. That's me, I'm sorry.
Huh? This is fun.
Oh, good. And I'm glad.
So they typically, you were saying that,
horses from the prison.
Yeah, we get horses from the prison, or there's a farmer on Barrett's Mill Road named McGrath. He used to have horses. And then when I joined the battery, they typically got the horses from Lawrence Kenny, who had a farm on Virginia Road. He always had one or two teams, and would get horses from Nick Roddy further down Virginia Road that had a stables, and he had 80 to 100 horses, and he always had two teams. Because the town used to contract with Lawrence Kenny, who was had antique wooden snow plows, and we used to do the sidewalks with them. Yeah, up until probably the early 80s is when he stopped, because he couldn't do it anymore. And I used to, help him out, or I'd work for Nick Roddy and would, plow sidewalks. Now they have the modern bombardiers and stuff, but we used to do it with horses up until the 80s.
And
it was a tradition. Lawrence Kenny used to do it, and there wasn't a lot of money into it, but it would pay for the feed and hay for the horses, and it kept them busy during the winter. Because typically, there isn't a whole lot of work for a draft horse in the winter. In this day and age.
Did they work in the summer? Were these
really Well, Lawrence. Well, Nick Roddy used to have, do hay and sleigh rides during the fall and winter, but he'd do them any time of the year.
What was his name?
Nick Roddy.
R-O-D-D-Y.
And he used to, he had classes, and then, in the stables he had owners, he would stable horses for different owners, but he would, be involved in trucking his horses to different events, throughout New England. And plus he had his own school horses. And he used to have classes like three or four nights a week. The beginners like with Tuesday night, and then the professional riders, the people that were really into, doing events and stuff like that, would practice other evenings. And every Sunday he'd have what they call a trail ride, which would be out around Walden Pond, over through Lincoln, and back into Concord, and there'd be anywhere from a dozen horses to 30 or 40 horses. And there were different groups, because sometimes it would split up. Some more professional riders would take a more difficult trail, where you'd come down an embankment, and there'd be a jump, and you'd have to take the jump and make a sharp turn, otherwise you were going to wind up in Walden Pond. But, I usually took the easy ride. But I still ride. I still go up to Arizona and ride. I spent a week in March in Arizona.
Not much call. He wasn't teaching people to work horses, though, or was he?
No. The draft horses were more of a, well, for Nick Roddy, they were part of how he kept the farm running, because they did make good money doing the hay and sleigh rides. They had these big pungs, they were called. It was called a pung.
P-U-N-G?
Yeah, and it would be, maybe a dozen, passengers plus the driver, and we used to go all through the woods around Concord and Bedford into Lincoln, Hanscom Field, because typically at night it was closed, so there's all these different roads that you could use, and it was pretty good. A little bit of hay, and everybody would bring a little something to drink to keep warm.
So a pung is like a spring wagon?
Or? Well, no, it's like a big sleigh. There were two sets of runners, and they were chained together so that if you turned one to the left, the rear runners would turn to the right. They had a cross chain. And every once in a while that would break, and the whole thing would kind of go askew. And We'd have to try and get a, you know, repair link on it, or everybody had to walk back to the barn and would come back and get the pung the next day. But it's, it, you know, a lot of that is gone now. I miss all the old dairies, and there used to be, you know, 3 or 4 dairies in town. They're all gone. And as a young boy, I used to go over and watch, now I can't think of his name. Well, it was Madison Farm and Denomandy and Verrill. Fred R. Jones was the one that was close to my house, and I used to go over in the morning and watch him milk and pasteurize the milk, and he'd bottle it, and you know, it was all local. Denomandy and Verrill had quite an operation, because down here where Dunkin' Donuts is and the rest of the building that's attached to that was Concord Dairy. And then, you know, the milk would come in there and be processed, and then it would go into milk trucks and be delivered. I can remember as a child being, you know, sitting in the kitchen, you know, having breakfast, and the milkman would come in and he'd put the milk in the refrigerator. You know, and then when he'd leave, you know, if we were up, if we weren't there, we'd go into a little insulated container, you know, and he'd pick up the empties. But he was an old friend of the family, so he used to just come in and put the milk in the refrigerator, and on his way out, he'd grab the empty bottles and, you know, say hello. And, you know, once in a while, my mother would offer him a cup of coffee. You know, it's something you don't see anymore. Nobody wants anybody in their house. And, I don't know, it's just, there used to be, in West Concord, where the West Concord Plaza is, there used to be a gentleman there that had a, there was a large barn that belonged to the Derbys, and, you know, they had sold the property. But he had a store in the barn. It was called the Yankee Trader. And he sold used furniture and clothing and penny candy and ice cream. So that was a popular spot for us. But I can remember, you don't mind if I just ramble on?
Oh, please. This is great.
I remember one night my dad came home and he had 2 passes to the circus. And I didn't know the circus was coming to town, but somebody came in and says, you know, the circus is coming on July 22nd, and wanted to put, my dad had a storefront on Comm Ave in West Concord, and they put these 2 posters up in the window, so he gave him 2 passes to the circus. And it was the Hunt Brothers Royal International Circus, you know, at Concord, was it right out field, which is in West Concord. It's like a series of baseball diamonds and soccer field and
called.
It's called, why can't I remember it? Right out.
Spelled.
I'd have to write it down. But anyways, Mrs. Rideout gave the property to the town for this field, and you know, gave it to the children. So it's a series of baseball diamonds, and that's where the circus set up. And I'd never seen anything like it, because it was, and I thought there would be a big circus train coming into town. And so I sat by the depot early that morning, and no train. Well, I came in a truck convoy from the other side of town. But it was the most amazing thing I'd ever seen, because of the you know, they actually set up a big top tent, and they used elephants to raise the tent. And, you know, it was just amazing to see, you know, because the elephants just stand there, you know, they had this harness on, and they'd hook these huge ropes to it, and they'd pull these massive poles would come up, and they'd stop. And then the tent would come up on the poles, and then a group of people would go around and they'd put smaller poles on the outside or perimeter of the tent. And then it had a gang of guys with stakes. And they'd set the stake, and these guys would stand around the stake and drive it. And it was like a machine. You know, everybody, it was a constant swing of the hammer. They would hit the stake, but there was a guy right behind them on the other side, you know, would hit it right after him, and then another guy in the other, you know, quarter, there'd be like 4 or 5 guys doing this at the same time. And they'd drive that stake into the ground within minutes. But it was quite a show, and I missed the show because the tickets were for the matinee, and I went to the evening show, and this guy said that all the tickets are no good. So we tried to sneak in, but that didn't work out either.
So your show was seeing the setup?
Yeah, basically, yeah. I mean, it was, you know, you'd see it on a TV show or a movie or something, and to see it in real life was completely different. It was amazing to watch.
It sounds like you were a kid who was much more impressed with animals than you were with machines.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I am. Well, my wife calls me a motorhead because anything mechanical, I'm fascinated with. And you know, I suppose that's where the interest comes from, because I was always watching the trains go through town, or you know, I work on old cars now. This is kind of a sideline. Different people have antique cars and. You know, I make minor repairs and stuff for them and help them keep them maintained. And,
So, did I hear you say your dad had a storefront?
Yeah, he was an electrical contractor. And so, my grandfather had a house in Bond on Commonwealth Avenue, and that's where they ran their business out of. After my grandfather died, my dad took over a little storefront in Commonwealth Avenue. It was basically just to store supplies in.
What's an electrical contractor?
He's an electrician. So he did, you know, electrical repairs. Excuse me, but, you know, he decided to do commercial work. And he did a lot of, you know, pretty special jobs around, all around New England. But, you know, I told you about renting canoes at Southbridge Boathouse, and before I left there, I wound up, you know, as a mechanic working on outboard motors, and, you know, but that led me to something else. There used to be a ski binding manufacturer in West Concord, and Otto Overgaard came to Concord from Norway as a young man, and he worked at Middlesex Ford, where Tuttle's Livery is, used to be a Ford dealership. And he worked there, but he came up with an idea for a safety ski binding, because typically it was a ski with a strap that, you know, ran around your foot. So if you fell down, something broke. It was either the ski or your leg. So he developed a safety binding, and, you know, he made the tooling by hand and developed it into a, you know, a multi-million-dollar business. And I worked for them for several years, you know, after school, counting screws and putting them in little plastic bags. To when I left, I was a tool and die maker. I used to be in charge of, you know, like quality control. I had to check, you know, all the parts that were coming out of the machines to see that they still met tolerances and so forth. But the company failed after they just couldn't keep up with some other manufacturers. But they developed the first safety ski binding.
Was there a patent problem that somebody else got the patent?
No, it wasn't so much as their design was very, it was a cable release system where other companies came out with a heel device that you stepped into and it would lock, but it would also, in the event of a fall, would release. So they tried to develop something similar, but it just never really caught on. They tried some other products like shoe trees, you know, to put your ski boots in, you know, but then somebody came out with a bag type of, well, basically a bag that you put your ski boots in, and that seemed to be more popular. So they just couldn't catch up. The development, you know, was so quick, and the industry was changing so rapidly that they couldn't keep up. And they sold out to a couple other guys from New York City, and they tried to resurrect the company, but it just never really recovered.
So we're talking the late 50s, early 60s.
Yeah, into the 70s, maybe early 80s. That's probably when the company, you know, finally failed, because I left there in like 1971 or 72. you know, to go to work for a construction company, and then I found the job with the fire department and decided I wanted to do that.
What year was it?
Well, I started with the fire department in 1973.
Well, what were some of the other industries in town at that time?
Oh, it was Concord Woodworking. They made, well, they called it snow fence. It was a very simple fence that would roll up, and, you know, you could roll it out. And what it did is it created a, like an air dam, and it caused the snow to drift in another place rather than on the road. You know, you could, you know, if you knew how to do it, you could set it up so that, you know, it would keep the snow from drifting across the road. And they still do it today, but they use plastic fencing. You know, another number of other products I'm not familiar with, but then there was slider units, which made sliding doors and regular commercial and residential doors and windows. And I think they sold out to Home Depot at some point because they had a plant on Beharrell Street. They moved up to Conant Street, and there's now a large apartment building there. Their building was torn down, and somebody built an apartment building. But there were a lot of small companies, too, in town that made any number of things. You know, I've heard a lot of stories about, you know, different individuals that developed, you know, small products and, you know, made them on their own. You know, they were never mass-produced in any great quantity, but there was, you know, a lot of light industry in town. Trying to think of what else we had. Well, it was General Radio. They developed a Variac. It had to do something with controlling voltage. You know, that was a small company that I'm not sure if they're in business anymore. That's now SolidWorks, which does a lot of computer drawing programs. I guess there's no other way to put it. It's a computer drawing program, but it does three-dimensional drawings and so forth that a lot of companies use. They can develop a product, you know, using this software, and they can see potential problems before they actually, you know, build it.
They call that CAD, computer-aided drawing?
Yes.
So you in 73, then the an opening came at the fire department. Had you had your eye? Were you fascinated with fire engines as you were with all kinds of other machines?
I did. You know, anything that was mechanical fascinated me. But what I did is I worked for my father for a while. After I left the construction business, I worked for Charlie Kamal. They were local contractors.
Charlie
Kamal.
Spelled
C-A-M-O-E, I believe. I'm a terrible speller, but anyways, you know, I worked for him for a number of years, and then I worked for my dad, and he kind of went into semi-retirement. He had a place up in St. Johnsbury, Vermont, and, you know, midweek he'd say, I've had enough, I'm going to Vermont. So I started working at Elmbrook Farm, you know, to supplement my income.
What was that?
That was the stables, you know. It's on it, which I had a connection to anyways because I liked horses. So this gave me an opportunity to ride more. And plus, John Roddy was a, you know, a dear friend of mine. His dad ran the stable, so it was just a natural thing for me to do at the time. And then I saw an ad for the fire department position, so I followed that up. And Tommy Tombino, who was the fire chief at the time, gave me the job. Because my dad, I'm retiring in June. I've got 38 years with the department. My dad had somewhere around 20 as a call firefighter. And my grandfather had 53 years in the call fire department in Concord. And he retired as a captain on Chemical 2, they called it.
Chemical 2.
Yeah, what it was is a soda and acid system where to provide pressure for the hose, they had, I don't know exactly how it worked, but it was a soda acid system typical to early fire extinguishers, and it caused an expansion in the tank, which would push the water out through the hose. And it was a chemical process. There was no mechanical pump to pump the water. But it was a short-lived system. They found the pump seemed to work better, and then they developed the rotary vane pump that is used today, you know, pretty much in every fire apparatus, because it's a very simple process and produces, you know, can move large volumes of water.
Sounds like such an ideal situation, though, working for your buddy's dad, working with horses all day.
Yeah, it was good, but you know, it wasn't great money. And the fire department seemed a little bit more substantial, but at that time we worked 10s and 14s, so I'd work 2 10-hour days, 2 14-hour nights, and then I had 3 days off. But now we work 24s, so I'll work Thursday, Saturday, and then I get 5 days off. So that was gave me an opportunity to work at the stables or work for a construction company. Or I had my own small business for a while doing construction. You know, do general repairs and additions and build garages. And, you know, my nephew worked for me, and he decided he wanted to do bigger things. So I said, fine, I'll work for you. So you have the headaches. You worry about things at night.
I'll go home at quitting time.
Yep, exactly. Because you know, typically I'd be at work and there'd be a bad storm, and I'm, you know, trying to put a roof on a house, and is the tarp still there, or did it blow off? But you know, there was a lot of neat things in Concord. There used to be the powder mills up in West Concord on the Maynard line, Maynard Acton line.
The what?
Powder mills. They used to produce powder for the military after World War II. It closed.
Gunpowder.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they may have produced other things other than gunpowder. Like, I mean, there's some high explosives today that were used in World War II. You know, they were much more stable and more powerful than the, you know, powder, you know, gunpowder was. But I don't really remember. You know, I know some of the buildings are still there, but I don't remember the process or seeing any of it operate. But my dad did, and. Let's see.
And the train, was there more than one train going through
Concord?
Oh,
West, yeah.
Concord?
Yeah.
What was the
train? Well, it was the Boston and Maine. You know, now it's just a commuter rail. But the Boston and Maine used to run freight trains through there all the time. And, you know, for us, like for me at night, you know, lying in bed and the freight train would be going through, and I had it figured out that if I counted every clickety-clack and then divide by two, that it was, you know, a 100-car freight train. You know, if there were 200 clickety-clacks, then it was a 100-car freight train, because there was a crossing there where the Boston and Maine crossed. They used to call it Concord Junction, and that's where the Boston and Maine crossed the, I think it was called the New York, Hartford, and New Haven Railroad. And, you know, and of course, they used to run freight trains through town.
Is that track still visible, that cross?
Yes.
I saw it this morning, I think.
Probably
I was
did,
through.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought, wow, this was where.
Through West Concord, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you would see that. The old right-of-way is still there.
Huh.
And, yeah, and then there was another railroad, and I think it was called the Fitchburg Line. It used to run up by the prison, or where the Route 2, where the state police barracks is. There used to be a what they call an engine house and turntable there. And it was like a, they could bring the locomotive in, stop it, and it was like on a bridge that pivoted in the middle, and they would turn the train around so it would face out the other way. And they had a big curved engine house, you know, and they'd back the engines in for repairs or whatever.
What they call it, a roundhouse?
Or yeah, roundhouse and turntable. There's nothing left of that. That's where the state police barracks is now. And then the state has a big building there that it's like archival stuff. There's a lot of stuff that's stored in there, and I'm not sure what it is exactly. But at one point there, the prison farm used to produce most of the food products for the prison system in the Commonwealth. They used to have, you know, huge fields of, because we used to go out and steal the cucumbers, you know, on a hot summer day. It was great to, you know, you go in and grab a cucumber, and it was a great little snack. You know, plus they had a big working dairy there that produced milk and stuff for the prison system.
Well, getting back to the fire department, mm-hmm. It sounds like it might have been kind of a family affair. There was your grandfather, what did you say,
53 years.
53 years. Yeah.
Well, he lived on Walden Street. At one point, supposedly, he lived in the tavern with his mother. But I found some information that says he lived with a Bartlett family on Walden Street. So he was close to the fire station because it used to be on the what they call Independence Court. And the fire station's still there. It's now an office or retail space. And the engine that was in there was called the Independence. And they built a new station on Walden Street, which was used up until the late 50s, and then they built a new station further down Walden Street, which we're in today. And we still have the original sign that was over the first, well, I won't say it was the first fire station, but the fire station that's at the end of Independence Court. And it was called the Independence. And we have a sign that was made by Rufus Hosmer, in 1845 is the inscription on the back of it. Because we took it down recently because they did some remodeling in the station.
Rufus?
Hosmer, which was an old Concord family.
H-A-S-N-E-R, H-A-Z-N-E-R.
Can't see.
We'll have to look it up in the phone.
Yeah, I mean, I'd have to write it, Hosmer. Yeah, but so the station's still there, and the ownership just changed, and the guy that runs Helen's Restaurant bought it, and he's trying to find some old photographs of the station because he wants to restore it to the point where it looked like, you know, or as it looked as when it was a fire station, but he's not having much success to find a photograph of it. I want to say my grandfather had some old photographs of town, but I'm not quite sure where they went.
So what else about your grandfather besides being a fireman was...
He worked...
This was your father's father?
Yes, as a young man, I don't know the name of the company, but he used to drive a wagon, because it used to be a slaughterhouse in West Concord off of Old Stowe Road, and he used to drive a wagon, and I believe it was twice a week, to Boston, you know, loaded with meat. And so, as the story goes, he was stopped in Arlington, and they commandeered his team because there was a huge fire in Boston, and they needed additional horses. So he wound up in Boston, and he worked caring for horses while the firefighters were fighting the different fires, you know, throughout the city. And I don't know the actual date of the fire, but it's how the story goes. So it's, you know, something that, you know, I heard from my parents years ago, and I never pursued any of the details, and I wish now that I had. But it was quite a town. Still is. I forget who I was talking to the other day, but we were talking about Concord and what a great place it is to live and grow up in. And, you know, it's just got so much history. And I think, you know, and my dad probably felt the same way, and my grandfather probably felt the same way, that there were certain things that were here when I was a child that are gone now, and it's a loss to the town. And, you know, I often think, is the town going in the right direction? Well, it's the only direction the town can go in. You know, it's going to grow to a certain point, and things are always going to change. But Now, my dad used to do a lot of work for Concord Academy as an electrician, you know, do electrical repairs and stuff.
Right, you
know,
cause,
yeah, it used to be, you know, just three or four homes, and now it's, you know, several homes, plus, you know, I've got a couple of huge buildings out back. And I mean, they were never there when I was a kid. Now, quick story, when I, as a firefighter, I took a promotional exam. And one of the things they did is everybody that took the promotional exam for captain got to be acting captain for 4 weeks. Well, it was my turn. It was September, and they had a meeting because the town was changing I forget what it was. They were changing something that had to do with house values. So they had a meeting at one of the local schools. Well, the place was a disaster. It was full of people. They had exceeded the capacity of the building. People were parked everywhere. And the police finally called me and says, you know, can you do anything about this? So I went up and I spoke with the town manager and I says, you know, I really don't know what to do, but I mean, we've exceeded the capacity of the building. You know, we're going to have everybody leave and reschedule the meeting. And he agreed to that, you know. And I guess the committee that was actually running the meeting was a little disappointed, but it was on the verge of being out of control. But anyway, so it was a nice, cool fall day, and we got a call for an oil leak at Concord Academy. So we went down, and the old gymnasium had an oil burner system that was on the roof. And something shot it out, and it pumped like 150 gallons of oil onto the roof of the building, which dissolved all the rigid foam insulation. And it got into all the storm drains and got into the storm system at the school. You know, and it was headed for the river before we finally got it stopped. But it was a major project for them to clean it up. And while they were doing the cleanup, they changed the oil burner to a gas burner. So there wouldn't be any more issues with oil on the roof. And then a few years later, they tore the building down and built a whole new building, which they have today.
The Concord oil spill.
Yeah. I've had a few. I've had a couple on Route 2 that were pretty massive, but we managed to, you know, the technology today compared to, say, 30 years ago, we'd put some chemical on it and wash it into the storm drain. Today we try and capture it all, you know, and we have these different materials that will absorb the oils but not water. And, you know, the EPA comes in, you know, they bring in clean harbors or whatever, and, you know, they dispose of all the contaminated material, you know.
So tell us about the 10 most exciting fires you ever fought.
Well, about three or four.
All right.
Well, the last one I had was on Partridge Lane, and that was pretty extensive. It was a fairly new home, and the owner had cleaned out the fireplace and put the ash in a plastic pail, put it on the back porch, and, you know, with the intention, you know, I'll get back to this in a few minutes. He knew he shouldn't leave it there, but trying to get the kids ready to leave at midday and, you know, all the other things that happened in the home during the day, he forgot all about it. So as they were getting ready to leave, his wife noticed that the back porch was on fire. So by the time we got there, typically today they use some of the modern materials are PVC based, and, you know, like handrails and balusters and posts are wrapped with this PVC based material. And it's very durable. You don't have to worry about painting it. It, you know, doesn't support mildew, but it burns very good. You know, so once the porch got going, and it's where it's on a hill, you know, the afternoon breeze came up the hill and just carried it right up through the porch into the master bedroom over the garage. And, you know, by the time we got it stopped, the whole roof of the house was gone. And they tore it down. And the sad thing is they were there, you know, on our arrival, and typically, firefighting doesn't always go as it does when you train, you know. Not that we had any problems, but it just takes time to get the truck set up, to move hand lines around. And as we run minimal manning because it's expensive, and it's, you know, it's probably 3% of the time we're fighting fires, as I was told years ago. 75% of what we do today is EMS, you know, medical emergencies. So, you know, we're kind of shorthanded, and I had to wait for the other engine company to come because under the federal regulations, my job is to stay in the street as the incident commander. But we can't always do that. And what we would do if there was a life hazard issue is, I'm not going to worry about water or federal regulations. You know, life safety is our first concern, and we'd do our attempt to rescue. But we did finally get water on it, but, you know, due to the modern types of construction and the materials used, the fire got a head start on it. And actually, it was Super Bowl Sunday because we were getting ready to make jambalaya and get ready for the Super Bowl game. We get called out. And this house is right up behind the fire station. So as we pulled out of the station and turned right, I looked over my shoulder. I didn't see anything, so I thought, well, this is probably like, you know, maybe steam from the dryer or something. Turned on the Hayward Street, there was a huge column of black smoke. And I said, that's when I struck the box, meaning a box alarm. That puts out a tone that brings in all off-duty firefighters. I got to the front of the house. I immediately went to a second alarm because I knew we were going to need help. That brings in other towns like Bedford, Acton, Maine, Sudbury, Lincoln. And, you know, by the time we get the first hand line into the house, I went to a third alarm, you know, because I knew we were going to need even more help. And it's kind of what they call a mutual aid pact. It's an agreement every town has. If you call us, we're going to send what we can. And, you know, the other towns do the same thing for us. So, let's see, I had a fire. This is probably 15, 18 years ago on Old Bridge Road, Old Marble Road at Old Bridge Road. And on our arrival, we had the ladder truck parked in the driveway, and a young lady came up behind me as incident commander. I'm out in the driveway. And she was hysterical and said, they're still in the house. So we had just gotten the crew inside with a hand line, and they had started up the stairs towards the second floor because the majority of the fire was in the attic space in one end of the house. So once she told me that there were the occupants were still in the house, the next two engine company, their job was to go in and attempt a rescue. And I ordered the operator of the ladder truck to take some windows out on the second and third floor, and I used the ladder to poke the windows out, and that gives the heat and smoke some place to go. So it makes it easier for us to come in underneath the fire. You know, as all this heat and material is moving up through the building, you know, it's easier for us to get through the building. Comes to find out they were away. They weren't in the house, but the lieutenant, after we had the fire knocked down, come out, looks up at the ladder and looks at me and says, does that little ladder look bent to you, Captain? Which means he was concerned that we may have bent the ladder, but we never did. But he was trying to give me something else to think about. It's typical of firefighters to, you know, give each other a hard time. It's, you know, he was just, you know, he was, because I took a step back and I had to look and go, oh, I think it's all right. But, you know, which would have been a big expense, but, you know, if we had saved a life, it would be well worth it.
But there was nobody in the house.
No, no one in the house.
That sounds incredibly difficult to figure out where to start in a full-size, smoke-ridden house.
Yeah, well, typically, you know, we had a fire here at Fritz and Gigi's, and why I bring that up is it was textbook. Everything went like clockwork. And we get a report of an odor of smoke because the front of that building is retail. The back is, there's a couple of apartments. And the woman in the apartment called and said, I smell smoke. So my thought was, well, it's probably from someone's fireplace or chimney. So we pulled up and didn't really see much. And I questioned her, and she says, yeah, I've been smelling smoke for hours, and I'm smelling more and more now. Well, this is probably early in the morning, so it's dark. Well, I took a good look, and I get a floodlight on the house, and I could see smoke coming out of the gable end vents. So we called for the box alarm. I had the ladder truck ladder the roof and cut a hole in the roof. And right in the middle of the building, they cut out a 4x4 section of roof. And just as they did that, the second due engine company, I had them already inside with a charged tan line. And when they opened the roof, the fire came right out through the roof. Well, they were there at the perfect time, this second engine company, and they opened up a hand line, knocked the fire down in 5 or 10 minutes. It's a small diameter hose that we move by hand. So we call it a hand line. That's typically what we use first. The house
about a 4-inch hose?
No. It's 1 3/4. 4-inch hose, once it's charged, you're not going to move it because of the sheer volume of weight. Plus, it gets very, very stiff, and it's almost impossible to move. So we use what they call an 1 3/4 hand line. When I first started, we used a booster line, which was like a heavy-duty garden hose. But that was state-of-the-art then. And with training and NFPA doing different experiments, they found that, using an 1.5 or 1 3/4 hand line is you can put down more fire quicker.
Sounds like a garden hose.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's like 1-inch, it's called a 1-inch high pressure. Oh, we don't use them anymore, so I've forgotten, but it's what they call a 1-inch booster line, and it's high pressure, but it's minimal volume, where the hand lines we use today are 1 3/4 with a combination nozzle, so we can either use a straight stream or a fog pattern. And we use what they call the indirect approach. So we typically will come into a room, and there's fire involved in the room, we're low, turn the nozzle up, open it up for 30 seconds, shut it off, and that pretty much puts the fire out. Then you open up the windows, and you go around and put out the hot spots, so you can put out a great deal of fire with very little water, if you have the right personnel and use the right technique.
There's a lot to know about this.
There is. I mean, it was pretty simple when I started, but after going through the fire academy and as the technology changes, it becomes very much involved, and it's much more scientific now than it ever has been.
And you've had to update your own training.
Oh yeah, we train every day is a training day in the Concord Fire Department, as the chief likes to say. So everything we do is based around training. Because typically every morning we go through the engine, and the ambulance, and the ladder truck. We check all the equipment, make sure everything's there, everything functions. If it doesn't, it's tagged and put out of service so it can be repaired. And then weekly, we do pretty much take everything off the truck, clean it, check it, make sure it works properly, and then it goes back into the truck. And every year we pull all the hose off and test all the hose. We bring it up to a certain pressure, and it has to stay there for a prescribed length of time. And then you can check the hose to see if there's any weepage or any leaks or the couplings don't look good or don't work correctly. And then that hose is taken out of service, to be repaired or replaced.
So you're there so many hours. I mean, sometimes you're checking equipment and sometimes you're making jambalaya, I guess. How does that all get determined?
Well, it's just what the group does. It's a group atmosphere, and we rely and depend on each other, and even right down to the menu. We discuss it at some point during the day, what's for dinner tonight. Because now we work 24-hour shifts. And typically lunch is something that you bring with you, but we all of us keep some foodstuffs in our locker, some cereals and stuff in case you get held over. But as groups, we each have a food locker, which we keep condiments in, some sugar, salt, pepper, dry foods and soups. But what we typically do is go out during the course of the day, we'll put together a menu, and if we go out on a run on the way back, we'll stop at Crosby's. you know, and pick up, you know, what's ever on sale for dinner that night.
It's
one or two guys that like to do it. I typically don't cook because, like, you know, I've got paperwork to do, and you know, I have all I can do to boil water. And I never. You know, I'd rather take the stove apart and fix it than cook on it.
Well, you have all this paperwork. What's your position?
I'm a captain, and I keep a record of, you know, everybody that's on duty. You know, if somebody's off for vacation, I keep a record of that. You know, an ongoing record each month as to how many sick days or personal days of vacation have used, because you accumulate like so many sick days a year. Each July 1st, you get, you know, it depends on how many years you've been with the department, but you get anywhere from 2 to 5 weeks of vacation. So I record all of that, and if you carried over any from the previous year, so I have to keep a record of each guy and you know, what he has for time on, time off. You know, if anybody's working overtime, I do a payroll for that day, which goes upstairs to be reviewed by the chief. You know, and then he'll sign it, and it'll go to town hall for payment. So,
I have to keep track of.
Yeah, and then, you know, and you know, anything that goes wrong with any of the apparatus, I have to keep a record of that and make sure that the maintenance people are aware of it. And you know, what I do is, like, when I get relieved in the morning, I'll sit down with the captain that's coming on duty and discuss different things we did and problems we had and if there's anything missing, excuse me, on the truck or the engine, we'll, you know, make him aware of it. Plus, we record it. We have a you know, like a bulletin board, and every vehicle is listed. And I'll say the vehicle is in service, out of service, you know, what equipment's been taken off for whatever reason.
Well, in your own case, it turned out to be a family affair, possibly, that brought you into the department.
Yeah, I don't say I went looking for the job, but I did take it, and it became a career.
What about the other personnel? Are there other people who had grandfathers who were involved?
So, not typically on the Concord Fire Department. There aren't many people that live in town anymore that are involved with it. When I started, I mean, everybody that was on the department lived in town. The call department was made up of townspeople. And, you know, if we had a fire, there'd be the 8 guys on duty plus a number of off-duty firefighters plus the call department and civil defense would show up, and you know, they were like support for the regular firefighters, but that's all gone today. You know, just, nobody wants to do it. You know.
How come nobody lives in town?
It's too expensive to live here. We had a guy from Florida that was selected for the fire chief job, or he was like in the top 2, and he came up and looked at real estate in the area and said, I can't afford to move up here. So he refused the job. So, that's the only reason I'm on the fire department, is I grew up here and I happened to buy a house, you know, a little house years ago, and I'm still there. But new firefighters can't afford to move into town. Same with the police department. There are very few police officers that live in town. You know, it's too bad, but it's the way the town's gone. You know, it's real estate here is very expensive. In my house, I paid $25,000 for it. You know, it's worth $500,000 now. And, you know, it's incredible. I mean, houses that, I used to see a lot of the estates because I worked over here where Chang Ann's restaurant is. It used to be worth more feed and grain. And I used to deliver feed and hay and stuff like that to different people at, you know, some of the estates, you know, and they had horses or whatever. So that was interesting. I got to see some really beautiful places, but now those places are pretty much gone. They've been cut up and, you know, subdivided and.
So do you feel like there are more sort of different echelons of wealth than there?
Oh, yeah,
people?
Yeah. There were a number of wealthy people in town, but it was more of a working class town. But there were wealthy people. It was Henry Lachlan, who had an estate up on Monument Street where I used to deliver feed and grain. And you know, I mean, he just had a great big place, and there were a number of wealthy people, but there was still a lot of working class people here. A lot of people from Nova Scotia used to come down this way. At one point, I think I was probably related to half of the town employees. You know, they were related to my family in some way. But that's all changed. There are very few town employees, you know, say in public works, that live in town, or the light plant, for that matter.
Does that produce a worker with a different level of commitment, do you think, if they live somewhere else?
I think it can, but what I see in, say, the fire department, and I can only probably speak to that, is that the people that the town has hired in the past 20 to 25 years are dedicated to their profession. Doesn't matter. And Concord seems to be a popular department compared to surrounding towns, because we have a lot of members on our department that have come from Acton or Lincoln, because it's a busier department. You know, we've got a lot of responsibilities. You know, we have the Emerson Hospital, which is, you know, it's a target for us, because, I mean, even though it's, you know, it's a well-maintained and cared for building, there's still a potential for a problem. We have two prisons. We have the Northeast Correctional Center plus MCI Concord. We have large nursing homes. And now Lincoln has a new nursing home right on the Concord town line on Route 2. And we go out there quite often, because Lincoln is a smaller department. They can't keep up with their growing demands. And I think Lincoln's department will grow, you know, over the next few years. Like I say, we have the nursing homes, you know, and they're our meat and potatoes, so to speak. I mean, we go there quite a bit. And a lot of people, I mean, probably 10% of the calls that we get are calls that they probably don't really need an ambulance, but they don't know what to do. You know, we've seen people with, you know, similar to a paper cut, but they want an ambulance and they want to go to the hospital.
Have any women ever applied to the firefighter?
Yeah, we had a girl in the fire department, and she was there for about 20 years, and then, you know, she got married and had a couple of kids, so the family became the... She had to leave the department so that she could, you know, care for her family better and spend time with the kids. And, same with the police department. They've had a number of female police officers, you know, and they come and go. And it's a transition to some of the smaller departments. We've had people come on the department, they want to be firefighters, but they want to get on a city department like Boston or whatever. So you start out in Concord, and then you wind up in Quincy or maybe Brookline, you know, or Belmont, and then you wind up in Boston or Cambridge, you know, which are what a lot of guys like to do. See, Concord is not civil service, where most larger cities and towns are. And, you know, guys will take the city the civil service exam and they get on a list, but it takes time to get into a city department, because it is a popular position. A lot of people like, well, I won't say a lot, but there are a number of people that it amazes me how many people want to be a firefighter or a police officer, and I wouldn't want to do that. I wouldn't want to be a police officer. I don't think I could do it.
What about the spouses of firefighters? Is there an auxiliary? Social involvement from spouses? Or
well, it was years ago, but excuse me.
Do they come over for jambalaya?
No. They typically don't come near the station. But like I say, they don't live in town. They're in Ayr or Fitchburg or Quincy or Chelsea or you know, Boxborough, Bolton. There was a ladies' auxiliary years ago, and it was more of a social fiber to the department then. I mean, everybody that was on the department lived in town. They socialized in town. They used to have the fireman's ball, which was a pretty big deal. But all of that has changed. You know, as you know, people move out of town, their, what would you call it? Well, they don't have the interest in the town that the people, you know, when they lived in the community, it was a social event.
Well, this has been great. I'm wondering what else we should ask you, or what you feel like you haven't talked about yet.
Oh, I don't know. I'm sure I'll think of a lot of things tonight. But trying to, you know, talk about different things throughout town that I, you know, experienced as a young man growing up. And my caddy did Concord Country Club, and that was an experience. It's just, you know, the different people that were involved with the club, that, you know, and how they reacted to the caddies. You know, it was different. You know, I saw there's one side of people that I had never experienced before, like, not to demean anybody, but, you know, doctors and lawyers were typically poor tippers, you know, but, you know, the regular guy, you know, would give you a good tip. And you learned that there were certain people you didn't want to caddy for. You'd see them coming into the club and you'd go around the back side, you know, so you weren't available. You'd wait for the guy that, you know, would give you more than 25 cents. He'd give you a couple of bucks, you know. But, you know, 25 cents actually back in the 50s wasn't bad money, because you could buy a whole lot with a quarter. Can't today. Popsicles used to be a nickel. You know, I don't think you can find a popsicle in town today.
If you could, it'd be more than a buck.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, that's what we used to go to the Colonial Stores over here. They had, not Colonial Stores, but the Country Store. And they had a whole section of penny candy. But I think just before they closed, going in and looking at the candy was much more than the penny. And I think the store that's in there now agreed to keep a little section with what they call penny candy, but it's still candy, and it's not a penny, but...
They have little drug stores where you could get, like, a soda fountain.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, there were two drug... Oh, here's an interesting story. You know, it's in a book here in the library. It's a chronicle by Lawrence Richardson of the Concord Papers from 1865 to 1900. I forget the exact date, but it's like 1890. It says, a young reveler threw a firecracker under... an ice wagon, which stampeded the horse, which ran through the center of town and took out the two corner windows at Snow's Pharmacy. And it goes on to say, Robert Merrill Prentice will appear before Judge Kies in the following week, which was my grandfather, because he lived on Walden Street, and he must have just, you know, thrown the firecracker and spooked the horse. But then there was a story about a horse or a team of horses that got away. And my grandfather supposedly stopped them by, you know, going out to them. And as the team came by, he jumped up on the horse and, you know, reined them in so that the... So, I, you know, I've only heard it through family members, but nobody else has ever mentioned it. You know, other townspeople that may have seen it or heard the story. But so I don't have any, you know, facts, but other than what I was told. Another thing, there was another section in there about a gang of Italians moved to town, and I always bring this up to Doug McCone because I grew up with him, and he's my dearest friend. And it said, you know, gang of the headlines read, "Gang of Italians moved to Concord," and it goes, "The McCone family will be working for the Wheeler Farm." Or,
the McCones were Italian?
Yeah, and they were quite a family. I mean, they had, you know, they were very hardworking people. And Ralph McCone, who they called Peanut because he wasn't much more than 5 feet tall, used to run a little hobby shop on Walden Street. And then he moved down the Lowell Road. He had a bike shop and, you know, he had sporting goods and fishing and hunting and he had all that stuff. And he was a real character. And he was on the independent battery when I started.